So in this context, there was a conjecture which dates from the late 80s, put forth, I think, by Peter Fulda, and then when Gertrude Wicknagel was working with him, that if one believed in this kind of a picture for the ground state of a heavy fermion system, that as you now heated the system up and you separated the conduction electron screening from the F electrons, that the F electrons' moments would now be revealed at high temperatures as they are. And then the idea was that if the F electron moments are present, that they should now no longer be in the Fermi surface, that they should be excluded from the Fermi surface, and literally that the Fermi surface should change size. I mean, that was the idea that was put forth. Not something that could be proved, because it's not a ground state, low temperature, you know, it's not a zero temperature theorem, so it hasn't, I think, the kind of sense of the Luttinger theorem about it, but maybe it's plausible. And difficult to test with low temperature de Hausmann-Alfvén, but it's the kind of thing we could try to get at with photo emission, which is hard to go to low temperatures with. So that's the flavor of what I want to try to put forward to you. And the essence of the result is that we can see this big piece of whole Fermi surface, we think, with photo emission at rather high temperatures. And then when we look at the cerium compound at high temperatures, well above the Kondo temperature, we continue to see this big piece of Fermi surface rather than the thing called the pillow, which is seen in de Hausmann-Alfvén. You know, that's the essence of the result. And then there's other bits and pieces I want to ask about if I can. So this is the band structure aspect to it that you're asking about. And the main thing I want to put forth is the idea that the dashed lines then are lanthanum, and the black lines are adding the cerium. And what happens, as best I can understand in this system, is that the F states really end up going pretty much above the chemical potential. And then if you ask what happens to change the Fermi surface from this to this, which are the two, you're doing something like what you suggested, that you hybridize Fs with pieces of the background band structure that has F character, and then you move these zero crossings. So the Fermi surface topology is not much changed, but the size of the Fermi surface pieces are changed, and in such a way that you end up now counting one more electron. That's how it works for this particular compound. And then it will turn out that you will mix some F character into the pieces where you have pushed the Fermi surface, and then the masses change, but they don't probably get as heavy as, they don't get anywhere near as heavy as you actually measure, but they get a little heavier. Because of some of this pushing and mixing that goes on. So that's my understanding of how the LDA works for this problem. And this is this big hole pocket which has to do with band 4, and band 4 has sort of moved from here to here and gotten a little heavier as a result of the F electron mixing.
But there's no F state below the Fermi level.
In some sense, there's literally no F state below the Fermi level. It's all sitting above the chemical potential. And for those of you who know how the Anderson lattice model works, in a way, for cerium materials, I think the Anderson lattice is not so different at a qualitative level. You know, then you would start with a state below the chemical potential, and then you would renormalize it in the Kondo sense and build some kind of an object above the chemical potential, which then hybridizes with the background bands, and it pushes the zero crossings. And so to me, at some crude level, the workings of the Anderson model is very similar to the workings of LDA for cerium, and it has to do with only having one electron.
Right.
When you look at uranium compounds, then it's different, and I won't talk about those, but a lesson we sort of took away from some of our work has been that the LDA for cerium, which needs to have two or more electrons, really has F bands literally crossing the chemical potential, and then the Fermi surface topology is quite changed from a background compound that didn't have any F electrons.
Have you tried to do a similar study for ytterbium compounds?
No.
You discover lots of interesting things if you do an think it's an accident that the band theory gets this stuff right. And the way to see that is when you go to ytterbium, which is like one hole instead of having one electron, you expect also that things would work very well, but they don't.
Well, okay, so a little bit more background about, so if,
can you,
if
before
yeah.
you do that, can you just go back to the Fermi surface?
Yeah.
Can you explain that just a little bit more, because they're not?
Well, this is a cross-section through probably the center of the Brillouin zone, and these heavy lines are hole pieces, and these light lines are electron pieces.
I see. So the thing that has expanded going from top to bottom.
That's this band 4-1. So it's I think this is probably band 4, and it's a hole pocket, so it's a hole pocket relative to the Z point.
I see.
So it's a big hole pocket, so and then the hole pocket gets smaller.
So the electron is housed.
So it goes the opposite direction, big and little, because it's a hole pocket.
Thank you.
Yeah, and for us it's attractive because it's big. You see, a lot of these other pieces are little small pieces around the Z point and the gamma point, and for photo emission, it's just beyond us to resolve those, as I'll show you. We can see they're there, but we can't really study them in detail. So let's see, if I were de Haussmann-Alphen guy, or if I were Gertrude Zwicknagel, I would, with great pride, show you this, because it's a really lovely piece of work from a community of people who did this in the early days. And I sort of bought into the idea that it was probably, you know, right in some sense, and that's partly because of the systematics that they seem to have built up. I'm sorry, I have a little trouble transcribing from one medium to another with this figure, so it's not as pretty as I wanted, and I don't want to dwell on it too much, but the idea is that out of this band structure, you can, first of all, get pieces of Fermi surface. And this is for Sirian-Ruthenian 2-cylinder. That's the famous pillow. And there are a couple of orbits associated with that one, or maybe more. And then there are also there should be some bits of red in here. And then there are pieces of blue and green stuff. And what's found when the renormalized LDA is done by Gertrude and her colleagues, which, as I guess you guys know better than I do, involves forcing the phase shifts at the Fermi surface for the F electron parts to be condo-like, which then renormalizes the masses of the things that are connected to the F electrons. And so this band structure now acquires some very heavy pieces, and then they can look and find out where are the heaviest pieces. And so in the way the story goes, the red stuff is the real heavy stuff, and the lighter stuff is the blue and the green bits, and the masses that are measured associated with these blue and green bits are modestly enhanced, but not the really big ones. And then the red pieces, which go with this pillow and with some bits of this complicated piece here, those are the ones that have the really big masses that mostly build up the big gamma value of 350 millijoules. Per mole Kelvin squared, which makes this material a heavy fermion material. So this community of people would say, you know, we worked at low temperatures, we worked near the ground state, we built up a theory that's designed to catch the masses right, we did the experiment, we found every orbit that's predicted, we measured their masses, we got gamma right, and it's a little package sitting there in the literature from some good people who have combined forces to try to build up this picture.
So can I ask you maybe I shouldn't ask you, okay, I'm asking, you know, maybe.
I probably won't know either.
So the Zwicknagel-Fulda thing, they preserve the LDA Fermi surface, is that right? But they twiggle with the position and the width of the F resonance, of course, to get the masses right also, is that so?
Sometimes the Fermi surface changes. My understanding is they run an LDA calculation, and then they sort of go in and put on there an energy dependence for the phase shifts of the F electrons, and then fix those, and then rerun the thing with those bits fixed. And sometimes the Fermi surface does change, and sometimes it doesn't. depending on details in Gertrude's written articles that describe conditions under which the Fermi surface will change or won't change. And it has to do with the relation, say, between the Kondo temperature and crystal field splittings and things like that. But she has some built-up understanding about how this works. Part of the phenomenology of the scheme that I think makes it kind of convincing involves now changing the spin state and seeing what happens, and in particular looking at this big pillow piece, which is easy to see. And so let's see if I can remember how this slide goes. In cerium ruthenium 2 silicon 2, that's the red one here, there are a bunch of de Hausmann-Alfvén frequencies, and they're sort of plotted here. And there's this thing called the psi one, and that's the one that corresponds to the piece of Fermi surface that we care about. And here's the lanthanum one. This is the big hole pocket, and this is the little hole pocket. And now we can turn on a magnetic field in cerium ruthenium 2 silicon 2, and we can drive the system to be a ferromagnet. And then as a function of field, there's this discontinuity. And when the system switches to the metamagnetic state, the psi frequency goes away, and this frequency, which is associated with the lanthanum big Fermi surface, pops in. Kind of pretty, I think. And then when they look at the ferromagnetic material, then they see something which is essentially exactly the same as what they see in lanthanum. So this is the evidence sitting in the literature that these guys have done the tests that they can do. You know, put on the field, force the spins to appear, taken a different compound that's very similar in character where it's ferromagnetic, see the different size Fermi surface. I thought it was pretty. You know, coming to this from the photoemission kind of Kondo resonance side of things, which emphasizes atomic physics, seemed to me I had to take all this seriously. And then it's an interesting question, what would you see at high temperatures? Okay, so I have to remind you a little bit about, again, this stuff about photoemission that I mentioned this morning. And now it matters more because we're really trying to do K-resolve stuff. Here's the Brillouin zone, it's a three-dimensional system now, and as you vary the photon energy, you move on arcs in K-space, and so it's important to know where you are in K-space. And we have, the way this is traditionally done is that you do vary the photon energy over a wide range, and you look for repeats in the spectra, and you choose an inner potential, which is your way of modeling the surface to get the change in K-perp from inside to outside the crystal. You find a V0, if you're lucky, that will map your spectra onto the repeating patterns here. And that was something Jonathan Denlinger did this work, was able to do. So we think we know where we are in K-space in this system. Okay, so this is, Jonathan, by the way, was postdoc with me and is now has a permanent staff position at the Advanced Light Source in charge of one of the beam lines there. So this is lanthanum ruthenium 2 silicon 2 done at two different photon energies, which cut through K-space then at two different places. And in principle, you're supposed to be able to move and sort of take slices through the Brillouin zones as you change photon energies. And this is what he got. So at 152 EVs, that we think corresponds to a situation in which these guys are mapping onto these big pieces of Fermi surface here that once. This is a Fermi surface map.
A window around the...
Yeah, I'm sorry, I should have said. Yeah, this is a Fermi surface map in which we have set now a window at the Fermi surface, a window at the Fermi energy, and we're looking all around in K-space and asking where are the electrons, where is it bright? Yes, I'm sorry, this is the map.
Just as a background information, from the point of view of resistivity, this is a normal metal, right? There's no Kondo effect, nothing funny.
This is, as far as I know, nothing funny.
Like aluminum, right?
Yep. Okay. This should be a garden variety metal. Yeah, as best as I know, that's the case. So our understanding of the thing is that these pieces are these bits of hole sheets around the Z point that are rather small. Although I'll maybe I may have some spectra here, I may not. But we can actually see the bands coming up and crossing the chemical potential. It just can't resolve little bits and pieces of stuff there. This guy, we think, generates that. And then bits and pieces of this complicated electron sheet, this one, for example, we think is generating this bits of stuff here. And it doesn't, in order to bring out this part of the Fermi surface, the image has been overexposed. And so the details there aren't shown very well. But the main message is that we're lucky that here's a system which has a big hunk of Fermi surface that we can try to see. Now, if you move to a different photon energy, which is determining KZ and also the maps, the map center's place in the Brillouin zone, these points now move to here. So you see the little squares are now in the center, and that's because we're slicing through K space in a different place. And now what happens is that this stuff now moves to here. And so in this system, at least, we think that we are resolving the three-dimensionality reasonably well. It's kind of not perfect because you still can see kind of blurry things out around here, but the change from there to there, the character of this guy is now moved to the center of the screen. And so it's that feature we're going to try and look for in cerium ruthenium 2 silicon 2, and we think that we've done as well as you can do in photoemission right now with this particular three-dimensional compound that's kind of our reference system.
This looks like this shadow bands exactly.
Yeah.
On the left picture, you see this image here of half of the translation, like a shadow.
I think that we have the sense that you're not perfectly K-resolved. I mean, one of the issues that comes up in this business is, what if you have some outgoing electron lifetime? Then that blurs the value of KZ a bit. And of course, if it happens to a huge extent, then you may wash out all of the features along KZ. And then you see, and there are some known examples, in which you see a kind of projection of all the density of states onto a plane that's perpendicular to the normal to the sample. Basically, I mean, that's the idea. If you would picture projecting the density of states onto a plane and so integrating it along the perpendicular direction, you sometimes see that in systems. And I think you never know in advance how a system's going to behave. Okay, so this, I guess, is our pièce de résistance. So these are our data taken at two different photon energies, the 152 EV1 that I showed you before, and this one done at 91, which is another one of those arcs that cuts through an equivalent place in K-space. And if we were at low temperatures and doing de Haussmann-Alvin, then we believe we would see this Fermi surface. That's the predicted pillow, so-called. And in fact, when we look, what we see is this thing that the green arrows point to, which is just exactly the same as the object we see in lanthanum ruthenium 2 silicon 2. And on some other transparency that I didn't happen to have in this sequence of slides, we could show you that the bands that generate these bits of Fermi surface are whole bands centered around the Z point, just to be sure that we're still seeing the same hole-like features. So we think that we don't, I think I have some fancy, so we think that we don't see that, and we see the same thing in the lanthanum and the cerium compounds for this one big piece that we think we could measure. And we believe that we really could tell the difference between this big guy and this thing, which is smaller and different shape, if we look at the right places in K-space. So that's the idea of the result. And on the basis of that, then we have said, and I do say publicly, that we have some evidence that the Fulda-Zwicknagel conjecture is right, and that if you measure at high temperatures, you find that the F electron is not counted in the Fermi surface anymore, which is a different statement, as Ole was pointing out, from saying what the spectral content is. And now I will come to that a little bit, because I'm uneasy about some aspects of the data.
Do you know what the transport looks like in the regime that you're measuring?
For cerium ruthenium 2 silicon 2 at 120K, you're in the regime where the magnetic susceptibility will have a Curie character.
And the resistivity?
Resistivity. Not sure. Sorry.
Because you see
probably, let's see, what will have happened? You will have turned on, and maybe there will be some crystal field features. And
you see the Fermi surface is not terribly well defined. It's some broad thing, because
This is the thing that people always ask me about, or maybe the first thing is, well, gee, how could you even see a Fermi surface anymore?
You see some Fermi surface, but it's as a broad thing. It's not a sharply defined object.
Well, it's what we see there. I mean, that's what we have measured. But I think, you know, it's a fine question. You claim that you decouple the Fs from the conduction band.
Yes.
And that means these Fs are fluctuating around in a Curie-Weisslie. So how come the conduction electrons can even know what they're doing?
No, they know what they're doing, but they're still having a jump in N of K, like you would have in a Fermi liquid. You have some sort of broad thing, some knee of a sort.
Okay.
Depends a lot on the lifetime. That's why you're asking about transport.
Exactly.
I should have resistivity curves to go with this. What I remember is that it's pretty ordinary heavy fermion compound where you have the resistivity turning on over the general range of the condo temperature and maybe going over some kind of a little hump. And then starting to just go up, maybe dominated by phonons even by the time you're at this kind of a temperature. But I'm not sure. So now you could say to me, okay, well, where's the F weight then? You know, so where is the F weight? And there is this trick I mentioned in which we do resonant photoemission, and this is the scheme we used to study cerium compounds in the early days. And you now go to a resonance photon energy. This corresponds to the 4D edge of cerium. It's 4D to 4F transitions, which provide intermediate states that enhance the cross-section for F emission. And so we can compare this low photon energy, well, this 91 eV spectrum, where the Fs are even a little suppressed, or certainly not enhanced. And then when we get to 122, we turn on the F stuff, and we can ask, where does it get bright? And it's not that there's no weight in there. I mean, it's not that there isn't any Fs, and they're just all gone, and you can't see them. In fact, this is a heavy fermion material, which all of you know generates pretty peaky stuff at the chemical potential in angle-integrated photoemission. So where is it in K-space? And where it is around these places, like these zone center places here and out here. These are the places that are supposed to be the low mass places. So it's not showing up in the vicinity of out any of the big pieces of Fermi surface. In fact, where we find it are these little things around the Z point and parts of this big guy which is centered around gamma. So somehow or other, where we see the F weight is in the parts of the Fermi surface that, within this traditional picture, are low mass, not the enhanced mass. And I don't know whether it makes sense or not. I'm looking at Kurt over here because, you know, what all I know is what I learned from the work that he and Ulla did on the Imperi model, where I learned that the really large masses go with small spectral weight, and then I'm trying to map that knowledge onto a lattice situation. But of course, I have no real. I mean, I as an experimentalist, and maybe in general, one has no clear way to know how to do that.
This is still 120
Kelvins. This is still 120 Kelvins. We actually have now taken data down to about 30 Kelvins. And it's been difficult actually to get the temperature much lower than that in the systems that we've been using. So no real change down to maybe 30 kelvins, but so that's getting comparable to T condo, but we're not well below it yet. And we may never get low enough to really match up to de Haussmann alpha with these experiments.
Can you explain again how you assign F character to a specific?
Yeah, the concept is that you just change the photon energy, and that at a particular photon energy, you have a very big enhancement in the cross section, and these resonance ones are quite strong. Let's see, maybe I could write a typical one on the board. So the way this one works, that you have a core level, which is the 4D core level, sits about 120 volts deep. And so that's the ground state of the system, and I'll do this in an atomic assigning of states now, because that's the way we understand it. And now you shine photon on the system, and you make a transition to a 4D9, 4F2. And so that's an excited state of the solid at 120 eVs, and it will decay by a variety of mechanisms. One way that it decays is by the channel that we care about, in which this excited electron goes back to the core level and makes once again a 4D10, and one more electron jumps out of the solid, preserving the energy in the process, and we get here a 4F0 plus an E minus that we will detect in our detector. And so the final state here is the same as if I had done a process 4D10, 4F1, directly arrow with H nu to 4D10, 4F0, plus an electron. So this step does not involve a photon. It involves the Coulomb interaction. And this has a distinct Auger character to it, that I have refilled the core hole and one electron has jumped out. But it's coherent, I guess, is the right word. Viewed in this way, this is a virtual intermediate state in which I just have a new channel for pumping photons into the system, but it's one that's very specific to a particular atom and a particular set of atomic energy levels. Now, it's also possible, you can imagine, that maybe this process is broken up and is incoherent. And I mean, after all, I've made a core hole, and it could be refilled in various ways. And that's this Auger I was worried about in the case of V203 this morning. So always here, you have various possible final states, channels, and this is the one that's really nice for the resonant photoemission. But there are other channels that generate real Auger, which just sends electrons out at fixed kinetic energies that are what you would see if you just did an Auger spectroscopy experiment and created that core hole by any means at your disposal. You know, you could zap it with very high energy electrons or photons, you'd create the core hole, and it would relax and send out electrons at certain kinetic energies. And of course, when you come right to threshold, in some sense, we're talking what happens in a resonance process when you come right to threshold, then these two processes can get mixed up. And that's an issue that you have to worry about in this resonance photoemission stuff. And sometimes we get tricked, as I showed you this morning, although we didn't get hurt too badly. And so far as we know, in this case of cerium, it seems okay. That is, this particular transition seems not to generate Auger that then comes and messes up the spectrum. That's the idea. In the past, we did this for angle integrated photoemission. And I think we didn't think to ourselves very much that, well, when we're tuning the photon energy through this resonance, we're also moving along the KZ axis in K space. Never really thought about that very much until we started to do angle resolved photoemission and thinking a bit more about, you know, what's going on in angle space. So it's possible that that there are some aspects of early work that maybe should be rethought a little bit, realizing that you're moving in K-space as you go through a resonance. But then, on the other hand, you hope that maybe these resonances are very sharp, so you can change the photon energy by 3 volts, and suddenly a big peak will come up, And so maybe you hope you didn't move too much in K-space and so on and so forth. But that's the idea.
So those plots are fixed omega transfer and the function of K, and the dark regions is where the most of the intensity is, or?
Let's see, the light regions are where the intensity is located.
Uh-huh.
So it's a fixed energy slice still around the Fermi energy. So this is still a Fermi surface map. So we take a window of kinetic energy around the Fermi energy, and then we ask where in K-space are we finding the electrons. So
right, but don't you expect that you should be looking like a couple of volts below the Fermi level to find that F content?
I'm going to show you some angle-integrated spectra in a second. And for sure, if you look 2 volts below the Fermi level, you will find a bunch of F waves.
Right, so...
The point which is surprised that I think you were expecting that by tuning the resonance, you would announce the F electron.
Yeah,
I sort
of thought that's where the Fs would show up.
Sure, there is no more much mixing. Nevertheless, if I'm able to announce the signal, I would be able to see the F electron just where they would like to be at low temperature.
No,
I found in a different position. This is the point.
Maybe not. Only just to say that having shown a piece of Fermi surface that doesn't house the F electron, nonetheless, that's not to say that there's no F weight near the Fermi surface.
Yeah,
there is F weight near the Fermi surface.
Where it is.
But where it is.
The position which you are not expecting.
That's right. It's in the low mass places, and I don't know whether that makes sense or not. That bothers me.
Take the Fermi surface. If on the Fermi surface you want to see where there is the maximum of the F weight, you would expect where?
Which is small anyway, right?
Which is small anyway.
Okay.
Would you expect when the mass is when the mass would be large? Why instead they are finding?
Sure,
I don't know.
It's
not obvious at all. I agree with you.
It's not clear. This is above the Legendre energy.
This is above the Legendre energy.
Above the Legendre energy.
A lot above.
Yeah.
The spectral wave is just in the region which there is a low mass. Around the Fermi energy.
If I'm completely naive, I would say that at the Fermi energy, I could even expect absolutely no F weight whatsoever.
For sure. But
that's the zeroth order
picture. But then there is
then
something...
We are saying, well, there is a little bit, where is it?
Where is it?
I don't know. I mean, why should it be where it appears below 20 Kelvin?
There is almost expectation.
Wait, if you look at the reference system, if you look at the Landrum system, where do you find the F weight?
There's no F weight because it's our reference system.
No, but there is also a little bit of F weight.
If you made the same
experiment.
To announce the F signal.
I probably have that data, but maybe not in a form where I could flash it up. But I can say that.
Could you want some more
for a lamp?
Yeah. On this Fermi surface, all the where is the maximum F weight?
Say again.
Where is this point one once again at LDA map? Where is where?
Yes, the F weight will turn out to be here, and in certain places here, which are the places where the big masses are. In LDA, the F weight would be in the parts of the Fermi surface where the mass has been enhanced. Because that's where you pushed the Fermi surface crossings and made them a little bit heavy.
No, but it means that this is this P band which interact by symmetry with Fs.
Right.
And that's it.
Yes.
So it should be in the London.
Yes. Yeah, this is a problem. So this is just a band theory effect. You just draw your fat bands and you will find some F weight there.
Why is in London there is no F weight?
The same experiment you can show the same
stuff. There is. In a solid, everything I hybridized with everything else. I mean,
I understand, but in experiment there's no F weight.
Well,
in the last way,
You might find a little bit, but you won't find a peaky thing below the Fermi level at the 2 volts and so on and so forth, but you might be able to find a little bit of F weight in a lanthanum system.
Yeah. In fact, you can program and you will probably get death weight.
Well,
by doing this right
now. I think I can say from out of my memory not much from looking at other lanthanum compounds. I should have had the bands plotted. I mean, I actually have figures that show the bands, and maybe I could, but I sort of deliberately got rid of a lot of stuff to make so I wouldn't be tempted to show you too many things. Look, I wanted to just show a little bit about good cleaves and bad cleaves, because we've done two things to try to, we're interested in angle integrated spectra, partly to make contact back to the work on the impurity model for angle integrated photoemission. And so, and then also it's one of the ways people have used to determine whether you're seeing surface stuff or bulk stuff. So I wanted to mention that there are good cleaves and bad cleaves in cerium ruthenium 2 silicon dew, we think. And this is an example of maybe a bad one first. And what you see here, so look, these features are the background band structure of the stuff. So these are these ruthenium and with silicon mixed in, but mostly ruthenium D bands that are coming up to define where those Z point hole pockets are. So this is what's generating those Z point hole pockets. And there's also other things that come up around the X point. And then you look and you see where's the F weight in this band structure. So bad cleaves tend to have smeared out this, by the way, so this is K in this direction and binding energy here now. So we're not looking at maps anymore. It's E versus K. And there are streaks you see of K-independent weight in such a one, whereas on what we think is a good cleave, you don't see these streaks of K-independent stuff. And you see little fine structures of K-resolved things. And so our sense is that, now this is an angle-integrated, this thing is the result of angle-integrating all across K. So here is the peaky thing that would show up in angle integrated photoemission from a typical cerium compound. So that's the peaky thing that in the past we have said is the photoemission side of the Kondo resonance. And that people like Ulla and I have spent time fitting it with the impurity model and so on and so forth. The 2EV feature is sitting down here. This is the stuff up near the chemical potential. And then on a bad cleave, what's known over the years is that you lose the weight at the chemical potential and it gets smaller, you know, kind of reminiscent of what I showed you in B203 this morning. So what we found out over the years was that seeing something peaky involves trying to probe the bulk, having good surfaces, and so on and so forth. But of course, it raises the issue that I'm trying to remind you now that all of this K resolved stuff adds up to that spectrum that in the 80s I interpreted along with Will Gunnarsson and other people, Kurt, as the Kondo resonance of a K-integrated spectrum. And of course, I'm really interested to try to know how to connect the two up in some conceptually consistent way.
But is this above TK or below TK?
This is always all above TK.
So why should there be a peak above TK?
Well, I think I might ask Kurt to make some comments about that, because I think he and Ulla had an understanding of why there would continue to be weight at the chemical potential even as the temperature was raised. And he probably can say the pedagogy better than I can.
I was talking about, say, that a photoemission part of the spectral weight, and if you look at this as a function of temperature, there still remains a lot of weight. This onset of the Kondo peak, you keep to see even at temperatures around the Kondo temperature.
Around 5 TK.
5 TK.
No, but here we have a factor of 5 or 6.
5 TK.
I don't have the Revy. I've tried to get this. It's a Revy article we wrote, because we have a picture there. I could show it to you, but it was not in the library here.
You remember 5 TK? You can
in the book of Hewson, 5 TK.
It's crossover. Here we are at TGT equal to
65 or
60
K.
5
TK is the case.
No, I don't believe that.
Todd, if you just look at the pure solids, MCL, so you do get a peak in 5 pk. It's of course reduced from the very sharp peak in the temperature, but it's still.
But how far below the free level are you?
And this just for a single impurity? Just a single impurity case.
Pursuing this averaging stuff just a little bit.
Just to finish this discussion, I mean, you explained to us, okay, so if you look at angular integrated, you say, okay, I see a peak here.
Yeah.
But you explained to us that if I now do the K-space surgery, okay, I'm finding that this peak actually comes from regions of the Fermi surface which are not the heavy mass.
Seems to be so if I would accept all that the De Haast van Alphen guys told me.
And there's no reason. It's not the Kondo peak.
Furthermore, there's no reason why they would have that strong temperature dependence that you see in your favorite impurity solver, because it's coming from the regions with a normal mass. There's no low energy scale there. So, by the way, have you followed the temperature dependence of the peak?
In this system, we won't see much happen, I think, at least down to 20 or 30 kelvins.
You see, but then it has nothing to do with what Schoenhammer is talking about. He's building, as he lowers the temperature, he's building the peak that goes all the way up to the unitary limit, right? So that's the Kondo resonance. This object is weakly temperature dependent, so there's no connection.
But if it is so, I think if you look at the NCA, you will not predict the big temperature dependence that you're imagining is there.
Yeah.
No, I think that's a fact.
You would see a factor of probably 2-3 at least in this temperature change.
You think 2 or 3?
Yeah. Well, at least, I'm not sure. No, it wasn't that much. If you put in some additional experimental broadening or so, I think it would really stay pretty constant.
What's your resolution here?
This resolution is probably somewhere up around 80 or 90, 100 millivolts, I guess, for these experiments.
Yeah.
I think that's a fair statement for this beamline where this was done.
And TK is like 2 millivolts.
TK for this 20 kelvins, yeah. So TK is really, really small.
Okay.
But there's a lot of weight. I mean, one other issue that came up in the impurity calculations that, maybe I should mention. There is a contribution from the F2 states. There is a transition from F1 to F2, which is really big in cerium because it carries 13/14 of the spectral weight. And in some sense, there's a tail of that that comes down across the chemical potential, or to put it another way, there are F2 states mixed into the ground state, and you can see F2 to F1 transitions. That generates quite a lot of extra weight and even binding energy in the impurity calculation. And so part of the extra weight that one sees around the chemical potential in the impurity theory, and we always believed in these angle-integrated averages, comes from that. And that was something that Ulla and Kurt, again, figured out after they put the F2 states into their calculations. So I have wondered to myself if that's the weight that could be appearing around the low mass regions. Just trying to make some sense out of it all. And of course, we don't have 10 more compounds that I can show you, because it's not been too easy to get this.
But you mentioned that you are going to do similar experiments at lower temperature. So
we're hoping
to be able to do.
Well, I mean, there are some beamlines now where the end stations maybe can get down to 10 kelvins or numbers like that. So that would be half the Kondo temperature on this system.
That would be.
Of course, you could also say, well, I'm just going to go pick a Kondo temperature that's handy. But then it'll turn out that it's in some compound where you can't get single crystals, or if you can get single crystals, they don't cleave well, and it hasn't been real easy to assemble. I mean, I think even this is more data than you'll find on. Maybe than any other system in the literature, and it has the advantage of having this nice De Haast van Alphen work that's been done and a whole bunch of stuff built up. Look, another possibility is, what if the De Haast van Alphen and all that story is not right? I actually don't believe that, but because it seemed to me so clean a story with such nice systematics to it. But anyway, this is now more sort of angle averaging, and we really made a serious effort to angle average it on a good surface.
The resonance photo energy, just done.
Just done on resonance.
Outer weather resonance.
No, this is on resonance to pick off the F stuff. And then moving around in K space, and the red thing is the result of doing the average, and down here is the 2 EV stuff. It's actually, in an impurity model, this would be a nice virtual bound state, but in fact, in the real system, it's broadened out through the SPD density of states of the material, so it's not, this is the 2 EV peak in this particular system. Well, I think maybe that's kind of enough. So it seems that at low photon energies, you actually can, in this system, from a good cleave, see a surface that's the same as essentially what you see if you measure at high photon energies on the Suga beamline, for example. And that, we understand, with this idea that I think is what the high TC guys would tell you also, that if you can find a crystal structure that admits of a cleavage plane where the atoms you want to study are in a layer below the top surface, then maybe they are a little bit immune to the surface effects, and then what you see even at low photon energies is relevant to bulk behavior. I think that's probably what one would put forth as an understanding for why the cuprate work, which is all done at low photon energies, is taken to be representative of the bulk.
But has there been studies of the cuprate photo emission at higher photon energy?
Shikamaru Suga has done some, and I have to say I don't know in detail, but my impression is that they have not seen spectra that would completely destroy the picture that's been built up at low photon energies. That's the sense I have about it, but I haven't looked personally in detail. There is, of course, still some protection for the low photon energy guys, that they can work with resolutions of 10 or 20 millivolts, whereas on the best beamline in the world right now, at the high photon energy, is still 100 millivolts. So there will, as I say, be a little protection there against trying to test in too much detail or make the comparison in too much detail. But that may change. Okay, I think that I just mentioned there's some FD mixing stuff. For those of you who like Anderson lattice models, we see in either two different cerium materials, if you look in the vicinity of one of these hole pockets, here's the D bands coming up, and then you will tend to see the F weight confined to the interiors of these D pockets. And this is the kind of thing that you might get from an Anderson lattice sort of picture where you renormalize a state above the chemical potential and then you have two-band mixing. And so that, to us, is a little bit reminiscent, at least, of how some of the calculations seem to work for the Anderson lattice model. That's really all I wanted to say about this and to, you know, just raise these issues of where should the F weight be? Does it make sense that it shows up in the low mass places? You know, those things bother me because, for all the reasons that, you know, that made them come to your mind. Okay. So if you're game, I would like to switch now to talk about low dimensional stuff.
Should we stop 5 minutes?
Yeah.
Cookies and kind of. 5 minutes break.
So maybe before we go on, I didn't want to leave a misimpression about the cerium systems that you can find systems in the literature which have been looked at with some care from the point of view of trying to find temperature dependence. And this is something Yves Baer has specialized in the years before he retired. And so, for example, cerium silicon 2 is a system that you've studied, has a condo temperature of, I don't know, 40 or 50 kelvins, which is pretty convenient. And so he has studied it over the temperature range and made comparisons to the NCA, angle-integrated photoemission now, and seen spectra that are in reasonable agreement with what's predicted. So if one believes there's a commonality to cerium spectra and that studying one is as good as studying another, then I would say that the impurity viewpoint has been well documented and well verified. And these efforts now to look at angle resolved work are just in their infancy. We don't have much in the way of theory to compare to, and not very many systems where there's enough detail to really know what's going on. So I didn't set out to give a kind of comprehensive overview of cerium here, but to show you a little vignette of one particular issue about the K-resolved spectra, this one material. Okay, so I didn't want to, leave a false impression that a guy like Yves Baer didn't spend 10 years of very serious effort establishing some results that I believe the community, for the most part, trusts and believes and accepts.
So, Jim, this Yves Baer study was on which compound?
Well, cerium silicon 2 is certainly one, and you can find others. I think if you would look through the work that Yves did, you would find several kind of model systems that he took and worked with great care. Maybe one other remark. It's not so easy to do temperature dependence as you think. I think the community is spoiled a little bit by the high TC work. Because the high TC problem is deemed so important, the crystal growers have put huge efforts into making these materials. And you can get really high quality, large single crystals. Imagine, now I tell you a true thing. We've done some of this work on the beamline that ZX Shen developed at the Lawrence Berkeley lab at the LBL for studying the high TC materials. And so, the same beamline and the same end station that produced some of the beautiful data on the high TCs is one that we're using. The sample holder is a long, long, long arm, which is a cryostat. It's like this long or so. And what happens as you change the temperature from 300 kelvins down to maybe 20 kelvins is that the tip moves by large amounts, millimeters. And so if you are having a sample that has the kind of inhomogeneities and roughnesses that I showed you for V2O3, where you got to tune around and find, the good place, you now change the temperature by 20 or 30 kelvins, and you're not looking at the same place anymore. So then what happens? So you try to re-optimize and get your spectrum back. But it can happen that the things you're looking for are subtle, and the changes you're looking for can be smaller than the changes you get from these inhomogeneities. If you have a big sample with a homogeneous, beautiful cleaved surface, these kinds of problems are less of a difficulty. And then furthermore, if you maybe don't care to work over such a wide temperature range, and not such a problem either. But I really think that just casually doing temperature dependence has not turned out to be an easy thing for any old sample that you happen to want to study. I believe that's a fair statement that maybe isn't appreciated as much as it could be.